Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. The S&P was up 24% for the year, while the NASDAQ more than doubled. He takes a look at how gold fared for 2023 and also the U.S. and Canadian dollars. President of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated, Danielle Park, is concerned 2024 will be full of financial challenges for debt-encumbered Canadians with a harsh recession likely. She is bullish on bonds. Author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble, John Rubino, gives us his expectations for the economy in the new year, what could cause a recession, and whether the theory of the great taking is real or not. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Ross, best of the season and Happy New Year.
Same to you and every one of the listeners out there. And we hope that next year is as good a year as the end of this one was. And, you know, what was this? 24% in the S&P, 53% in the NASDAQ. So pretty good year on the upside. And for a pre-presidential year, you expect that to be a good one. But this one was way above average. So it, unless you were in Canada and then the TSX was only up 8%, you know, we got held back a bit because of the mining area and energies. But overall, you know, the bank index in Canada did pretty well, and some of the high flyers moved along as well. So, you know, in Canada, you really can't complain too much as long as you have some diversification.
How good a year did gold have?
Gold finished off the year nicely, and now pretty much everything across the board was down a little bit on Thursday, Friday. Just I think there was some profit taking in there. The U.S. dollar bottomed out and had a little uptick. So for gold, the stock markets, the oil market, everything priced in dollars was down a shade. Looking at the 2035 to 2040 area on gold as an important support level, and as long as that holds, I think we'll see a continuation to the upside in January. You know, the seasonality here, 47 days minimum on the seasonal rally, and we're only, you know, we've still got some time left on that. The trend is up without a doubt, and let's just see if we can take out the all-time highs. I think we've got a pretty good chance of that. Silver market, not quite as strong. In the last couple of weeks, it recovered 62% of the decline it had from that Sunday night high when gold and silver had the big spikes up. So silver is just languishing a little bit here, but you know, it's still got an upside bias to it.
What's going on with crude as we end the year?
Well, crude doing pretty much what you expect. You expect to see a seasonal low form during December, January. So here we are. We put in a good low about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. Had a bounce, and now we're coming back down to retest the low. And that is so common as far as the oil market is concerned. And I think if we can hold the lows that we put in on that first break, most recent one, then you've got the seasonality, which as we get through the second half of January, starts to gain some momentum and carries you right up into February and ideally into April. So there's some pretty good potential in there. And if markets overall are reasonably buoyant, then oil's got a chance to do something. And when we take a look at the seasonal pattern on the presidential cycle for the S&P and the Dow, you normally would get a bit of a pause in the first quarter of the election year and then start to come back to life again. So that might be enough to cause some exuberance as far as most of the markets are concerned.
How are the Canadian and U.S. dollars ending up?
Canadian has held up reasonably well. I mean, you know, even with this drop that we've seen in crude oil in the last few days, the Canadian is nicely trading within this 75.5 resistance area with 72 as a support, and we're in the top quartile of that as we finish off the year. The interest rate spreads are between U.S. and Canada are reasonably supportive to the market at this point. So unless we see some divergence with the say oil starting to come to life and the Canadian dollar not matching it, that kind of a divergence would be worrisome. But for right now, the dollar seems to be holding its own. And when we look at it, as I say, on a relative basis to commodities and interest rates, the bias is still for this support area to hold and maybe have a little bit of life on the upside.
Ross, all the best of the season and have a great new year.
And the same to you and all your associates. Thank you.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. Check him out on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Danielle Park next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show, Danielle, and best of the season.
Yeah, you too, Jim. Thanks.
The Dow has hit new highs, the Toronto Exchange and the S&P 500 getting close to new highs. What do you see ahead for the equity markets?
Oh, well, the equity market is rallying sharply since October the 3rd when it was at a low. It's gone up a dramatic amount since then on this belief that this U.S. Fed in particular will be cutting interest rates starting in as early as March of 2024. And so while I think that that is a possibility based on slowing inflation and slowing demand in the world economy, I do think we're into a disinflationary phase here for a bit again. The problem is, of course, that stocks, in fact, when you get into a contraction in the economy, so it's kind of like an oxymoron. They're saying, oh, great, they'll be cutting interest rates in the new year because things are going to be looking worse and the unemployment rate is rising. But they're forgetting the part that is that stocks fall, have the bulk of their bear market losses when the cutting cycle actually begins. So although it's very common to see these relief rallies, and we've had them, I've been writing about this, we've had them repeatedly at the, you know, near the peaks of past cycles in the stock market, you get this big belief that cutting rates will save the day. But just as hiking rates took 12 to 24 months to filter through the economy and really make a difference in terms of crimping off demand, cutting rates also takes time to filter through and doesn't work as a quick fix to anything that ails us. And so it's interesting the dichotomy, for example, between stocks and bonds. So government bonds are one of the few assets that rally during the cutting phase of the easing cycle as stocks are falling. But right now we've got both of them rallying, right? So we've got this massive upturn in the price of government bonds since October as well. We've had more than 20% rally in the 20-year it's called the TILT, so the 20-year Treasury Index from the U.S. The Canadian 10-year Treasury price is up more than 15% since October the 3rd. So we've had these kind of big booms in past at the beginning of the what will become the next easing cycle. The Russell 2000, which is a small cap stock index that's typically considered the most economically sensitive and more so than the broad markets, it also has rallied more than 24% in the past 2 months. That's the third largest, quickest two-month rally in history. But again, it doesn't make any sense in the context of a slowing economy, potentially recession very likely, and the cutting cycle that is expected in 24. So, you know, stocks are kind of like the idiot cousin, if you will, of the Treasury market. They're unduly optimistic at all times. And then typically at cycle bottoms after, you know, the drubbings have been the worst, that's when sentiment finally shifts to pessimistic, just when it should be optimistic. So it's very common to see this kind of overzealous take heading into the cutting cycle. But, you know, the interesting thing under the hood, it's been, again, largely led by this handful of mammoth, expensive tech stocks, right? So 31% of the S&P is in these 10 most expensive stocks and about 45% of the NASDAQ. And when you look at the equal-weighted index, you know, the balance of the other components of those composites, they actually are still negative year-to-date. So it's been a very bifurcated, narrow market. And markets are infamously the least strong and the weakest when they are the narrowest. And that's exactly what we're seeing today. So the TSX is about 5% off its peak. It's, again, been led largely by financials in this rebound. Again, the interest sensitives that sold off most during the hiking cycle have really rebounded sharply during this prospects of cutting. The thing that people should be a bit careful of here is not just, as I say, that equities get this wrong and then the worst of their declines come as the cuts finally start. Because if you think about it, we've got the stock markets today back where they were in the peak of the cycle in early 2022 at a time when PS policy rates in terms of the central bank base rates were 0.25 at that point, Jim, and they're 5.5 today in terms of the U.S. rate structure. So we've got a massive increase in the cost of capital within the economy, and yet the stock market is, you know, back whistling Dixie. So I think we have to be very concerned about that. It's really a classic playbook. And as long as you understand that, you realize that the pessimism is misplaced. The great optimism is misplaced.
Seems like everyone's predicting interest rate cuts next year. Do you agree with them?
Well, this is the point, more like the collective vote from the Treasury market is for significantly more rate cuts right now than the Fed chair was intimating at the meeting last week. So he was suggesting, you know, you could see as much as 0.75 in cuts. That's kind of the dot plot base case for 2024. But the Treasury market has really taken that and run and is estimating at least twice that in 2024. So there's a widely held belief that the data is going to be coming in quite negative in the first quarter, and that will spark a reaction from central banks. Now, I do agree that if we get an increase in unemployment, which is their other mandate, right, it's not just about price stability. So we have inflation moderating significantly, coming down sharply from the peak of the summer of 2022. So that's their first signal that they are, as they say, they think they've done enough in terms of battling inflation at this point. But the unemployment rate is spiking higher. So we've got continuing claims and unemployment claims both rising more than expected this week in the latest data. So that trend, as it continues, is likely to be the catalyst, I think, for the rate cuts to begin. So I do think that's the case. I'm not sure if I agree they're going to go as rapidly as the market is currently pricing. I think Chair Powell, at the helm of the Federal Reserve, has a wish to go down in history as a person who killed the Fed put, who killed the, you know, belief that central banks will go back to zero as soon as there's the slightest wobble in the stock market. And we shall see. I hope he has some tenacity and ability to stand and do the right thing in the big picture rather than, you know, placate again to the speculative crowds. But we shall see. That remains to be seen.
Is debt a widespread problem in Canada?
Well, infamously, we are in some of the worst debt dynamics of any country in the world today, especially in terms of our private sector. We have, you know, two indicators. I mean, this is the same actually in America, but the absolute levels are less there because the peak of their credit mania was, of course, the 2006 housing bubble that burst and some people, you know, paid off debt or learned lessons, behavior changes in the aftermath of what went on there. And today, more Americans actually, owner-occupied homes have about 60% of them have mortgages, which is less, which is more than back in the 2006 peak, whereas Canada's gone the opposite. Today, about 74% of Canadian homes have mortgages. But it's also these other types of debt, right? It's the Canadian credit card debt is been exploding higher. The actual consumer debt is about almost $3 trillion in the third quarter, and it's been leaping, you know, $80 billion just in the past year. And rising credit card debt is considered an excellent predictor of a future rise in insolvencies. And in fact, that's what we're also seeing in the trustee data in terms of insolvencies. With credit card delinquencies have risen about 40% over the past year. And consumer filings nationally have increased 23% just in the first 10 months of 2023. So we definitely have problems with our debt. And this is all while, don't forget, only about a third of Canadian mortgages have already increased in rate. And looking out for the next couple of years, all those mortgages that were taken out during the pandemic at, you know, some rates less than 2% are going to be up for renewal, just based on their fixed terms coming to an end over the next couple of years in 2004 through 2007. And that means that the Bank of Canada estimates that most people will see at least a 34% increase in their mortgage costs because of the increase in interest rates that's likely to be taking place between that record low rate they originally got during the pandemic and then more normalized rates of late. And for the other highly indebted people, the estimate is that their mortgage payments will go up by about 54%. So I think that is going to be a problem. I think it's already showing up. A lot of you know, secondary properties, vacation rentals, chalets, cottages, a lot of those listings are already coming to market because people are just finding that they have too little cash to go around already. And that's, you know, even as I say, before the bulk of these renewals have come up for refinancing. So yes, we have a big problem with debt. And the major problem there as well is that we need to have a huge increase in productivity in order to help, you know, make those payments and afford the higher cost of living. But we are actually having the opposite trend in Canada, right, where our productivity levels, our output per worker, has now been falling for 20 years. Some OECD data has shown that Canada has, you know, we were actually slightly above the OECD average of countries in 2000. We were slightly above the average, but now we're actually significantly below the average. Our productivity has fallen by about 5.6% since 2000. And that's a function of this misallocation where we have put so much of our resources into the financialization of the economy, into trying to promote debt-based consumption rather than investment, rather than things that will actually help, you know, increase productivity. So the OECD points to Canada right now as being one of the countries to perform the worst over the next 20 years based on the current dynamics and policies that we have in place. So we really have a lot to gain here in restructuring the way we allocate policy in terms of fiscal and monetary supports, but also in terms of the things we give tax deductions for, you know, in the terms of the things that we incent in the population. Right now, it's too much based on consumption and housing. Our economy is actually 20% more dependent, our GDP, 20% more dependent on the housing sector today than the U.S. was at the peak of its 2006 housing bubble. And again, it's just a very, it's made our economy undiversified and fragile going into a global downturn. So it's not good.
With a number of interest rate increases and significant debt, is Canada likely in or headed for a recession?
That is the base case. That's not just me saying that. That's a lot of the major bank, like BMO and Royal, TD, they all have a sort of baseline now. They all say a mild recession, right, because no one likes to say anything about recession. It's considered doomy and gloomy. And I like to say they want to shoot the messengers wherever possible. I was writing about this week where in China, anyone that's been trying to warn the public about, you know, trying to tell them don't put capital in the stock market, which has been falling forever, by the way, and also to avoid housing because it's in this multi-year contraction in the third year of its downturn, and there's still a lot of sketchy debts and vacant properties and all sorts of things yet to work out. But the Chinese government has been clamping down on the people who have been trying to warn the public through social media, and they're just sort of disappearing. Well, that kind of thing goes on in Canada too, where it's a very unpopular, you typically don't get asked onto mainstream media, you know, television, this sort of thing, business news, if you have any kind of a glum outlook, because the sponsors want to keep it all rosy. But the fact is that we are lining up here for, you know, we've already had very weak GDP for five consecutive months, basically flat for 5 months. And it's looking like that trend has not turned around with holiday shopping or any of that stuff that happened in the fourth quarter. It's been very weak handoff into 2024. So yes, it looks like Canada's economy is contracting. So far, people are saying it'll be mild. But, you know, again, relative to asset markets, mild doesn't really matter. Like, they talk about mild as if it somehow won't be an issue if it doesn't last too long. But ultimately, it's not about the depth so much as it is the reality that people are ill-prepared for a loss of income. In any kind of recession, you're going to see a bump up in unemployment, which is going to be a further challenge to households which are already struggling to make payments.
Is real estate the elephant in the room for Canada's economy?
Well, that's, I guess, what I've been talking about. It's not so much an elephant. It's very widely recognized worldwide that Canada has a housing problem. It's an unaffordability crisis. The Bank of Montreal was writing about this recently, which just points out that, you know, the bulk of households have to spend more than 54% of their income in order just to keep shelter over their house. Meanwhile, the long-standing affordability norm was 30%, that you shouldn't spend 30%, more than 30% of your household income just to have shelter. Well, obviously, you know, we're almost twice that. And in many of the highest population areas, it is more than twice that. People are having to spend like 80% of their income to try and keep their shelter. So clearly this is a huge problem. Again, it's a function of too high of prices. And if you talk to anyone that's in the industry right now, they will admit mostly that there's no transactions taking place in properties over $1 million, virtually none, when that's what actually the bulk of the supply in Canada is in the higher than $750,000 category. And people are just not able to qualify for loans to purchase that kind of pricing. So you've got a rising inventory just as you've got less and less buyers able or willing to take part. So Canada's got a classic downturn going on. It's been in play now for a couple of years, but these cycles can easily take 3 to 5, 6 years to play out. And very importantly, many of the measurements are warning that this is similar to what we saw in terms of unaffordability and pricing in the 1980, just before the 1980 housing downturn and double dip recession, by the way, that came in 81 and 82, when home prices fell by a lot. 40% in many areas, and that, in fact, is sort of the setup that is most comparable to what we have right now.
Yeah. So are we going to repeat the 80s?
Well, I mean, nothing is ever exactly a repeat, but I would not be surprised to see a very sticky downturn in terms of home prices. And that will always, traditionally, downturns in housing have had the worst impact on the economy. So, again, when you go into these periods of bubbles are lots of fun on the way up, and they're pretty devastating on the way down. We've been aiding and abetting a housing bubble in Canada for many years with our policies, choices, and behaviors. A lot of speculative fervor going into that sector. And it's been, you know, promoted as if we don't have enough supply. No, what we don't have is enough supply of reasonably priced shelter, whether that was, you know, to buy or to rent. And so that is the sort of the bullseye on our economy, is that those prices need to deflate back in line with household incomes. And that's going to be a painful process for many people.
When a housing bubble collapses, do higher-end homes drop by a larger percentage and lower-end homes by a smaller percentage?
Well, the percentage is pretty consistent. It's just that when it's in a more expensive house, it tends to sound bigger. You know, the more, like, the 20% on a home that's $1 million is, $200,000, and on a home that's much more expensive, it's a much higher number, so it sounds a lot worse. But actually, I think the point is more, there is a misunderstanding or a misperception that very expensive homes are somehow immune, right? That I've heard this so many times, that, oh no, wealthy people, you know, the people who are owning the most expensive homes are, you know, immune from any impact from interest rates. There's this misunderstanding that most of those people buy cash and don't use credit, and so there's no impact on them, and they'll keep somehow buying, you know, at all-time highs, regardless of what's happening in the business cycle or the overall economy. And that's never been the case. That's just nonsense, and I've mentioned that many times, but people are really starting to see that. I'm hearing from people who are saying, you know, it's quite shocking that, realtors are saying they haven't had a deal in more than 5 months. There's basically just a dearth of available or of interested buyers who are able to qualify for these things. And there's, of course, this is the point, there's so many expensive homes, certainly in the GTA and the Greater Vancouver area, Montreal, where most of the population lives. This is where the bulk of the homes got so insanely priced. And so I think that we're likely to see until interest rates come down significantly, and again, until household income can improve, which is going to take some time, especially going through a recession, we're not going to see much support under the Canadian housing market.
We keep hearing immigration will keep home prices high. Immigration significantly higher in Canada than it was, with most immigrants heading to either Vancouver or Toronto. Are these new immigrants potential home buyers when they arrive?
Well, sure, but it takes years, right? Yeah. It's the bulk of people who come to the country are first focused on education and training and getting a good paying job. It takes time typically to make that adjustment, and the average time between a new immigrant coming and them able to buy a house was traditionally 7 years over the long run, and that's before prices became so disconnected from reasonable multiples of household income. So I think it would be probably more than 7 years today. It's worse than the historical norm. So I think the bulk of new immigrants are looking for affordable rentals, and that's probably the area where, you know, we need to see more of those available, and the rents are going to be pressured lower as more properties are given up as secondary, you know, as I say, cottages, chalets, vacation rentals, as more of those properties are put on the market. And we're starting to see that, at some point, as prices come down, they become more attractive as rentals. Again, in the environment we were in, most properties made no sense as a rental because the price was so expensive that you were a negative carry property, right? Even if it was fully rented, even if it was a full-time rental, you still were in the hole, you know, hundreds if not thousands of dollars a month. Well, that's all got worse, and in the 34% of mortgages that have actually moved higher in the last couple of years in terms of with the interest rate cycle, and of course, the bulk of the ones that are still coming up for renewal are facing even, you know, very heinous math as well. So I think we'll see more of those properties come up for rental. That will help bring the price of rents down. We're also seeing record amount of multifamily building in Canada, and that will help in many of the high population areas. But it, you know, again, it's more about a rental story when you're talking about new immigrants than it is a buyer story. Ultimately, some, you know, a good portion of those people will get on their feet and get going and save and be able to buy a home. But that's down the road for the for most of them.
Overall, are you bullish or bearish for 2024?
Well, I'm pretty bullish on bonds. I got to tell you that. I'm very excited actually about the prospects of that, because as I say, they've already been rising since October, and that's actually consistent with historic norms where you're going into a rate cutting cycle. Typically you get them appreciate significantly more during the rate cutting. I mean, the last time that we were anywhere near this pricing, you saw equities drop, you know, sort of 30 to 40%, and you saw government bonds rally another 20 or 30%. So I think between the two asset classes, one has great prospects in this environment. One has significantly more downside, that being the equities. But I am quite optimistic that we could get a really attractive buying opportunity for equities as well once we get further into the cutting cycle. As I say, typically equities fall all the way till they're basically done the cutting cycle, and then it takes some time for that to filter through into the economy. So you continue to see the recession look bad, and unemployment continues to rise even after that sort of last rate cut. But equities ultimately start to price in forward-looking indicators, and they tend to rise then not long after the rate cutting cycle is complete. So it depends on your time frame, but right now I'm bullish on bonds going into 2024. At some point later, perhaps in 24 or potentially early 25, we're going to be very bullish on equities again, and so that is sort of the two-part answer.
Any New Year's resolutions?
Well, I always have the same resolution each year, which is to hopefully be wise and useful. Those are my two main goals in life, and everything I do is trying to try and be wise and useful and try and help other people. So I'm going to keep doing that in 2024.
Where's the best place for people to follow you?
JugglingDynamite.com being my almost daily blog that I write for free to the public, and VenablePark.com being our asset management company.
Danielle, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to everyone.
My guest has been Danielle Park. Her websites, VenablePark.com and JugglingDynamite.com. Coming up, John Rubino, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. He's speaking to us from Port Angeles, Washington. Welcome back to the show, and best of the season.
Hey, Jim. Happy New Year.
How do you think the economy will do in the new year?
I think badly. A hard landing is probably what we're going to see in the first half of 2024, mainly because consumers are tapped out, you know, especially here in the U.S. I don't know how it is in Canada, but we took on massive amounts of credit card debt in the last couple of years, and car loans, and, you know, to an extent, mortgages. And now student loan payments are kicking back in. Credit card debt is above $1 trillion, and personal interest is spiking straight up. So there's no way consumers lead a strong economy until a lot of that debt gets wiped out. And the only way you can do that is through a recession, through everybody defaulting. So that's my prediction for 2024.
Almost everyone's saying interest rates will drop in the new year. Do you agree?
Yeah, generally speaking, I think the Fed is going to keep rates stable for a little while, and then when the economy starts to slow down, they'll do their usual panic, and they'll be cutting aggressively by the end of the year. I don't think this time around it fixes it. That's the really big story, that the old monetary tools stop working. And that's, I think, the big story of 2024 is the year that the experiment failed. So we'll see.
Is commercial real estate as bad as it seems, and what does it mean for the banking sector?
Well, it's pretty bad. If you're looking at possible catalysts for the next crisis, commercial real estate is right up there, because over the past decade or so, when interest rates were extremely low, a lot of buildings, especially office buildings, got put up using extremely cheap money. Now, two things happened since then. One is that after the pandemic, fewer and fewer people have gone back to work in office buildings. So a lot of these big buildings have really low occupancy rates, which means low cash flow. And interest rates have gone up. So these buildings, they either have to be refinanced or sold going forward, a lot of them, and it's happening on really unfavorable terms. You're seeing a lot of buildings out there that maybe sold for $200 million in 2014, or now they're being sold for $100 million, you know, 50% off in less than a decade. That means there are losses out there that somebody has to take, and the banks will be on the hook for a lot of them. So there's going to be a lot of really scary quarterly reports, especially out of local and regional banks who have a lot of real estate paper, when they have to report these losses. So be prepared for that and what it does to deposit flows and bank stock prices and bank viability and the need for a government bailout. Yeah. All of that is kind of going to come one after another as this year unfolds.
Now, in Canada, 60,000 people were laid off by the banking industry this year. Did anything like that happen in the U.S.?
Yeah, there are layoffs going on in the U.S., but we haven't seen anything yet because the federal government stepped in and bailed out several busted local and regional banks earlier in the year. And that kind of led everybody to the conclusion that the government stands behind the entire banking sector. And that remains to be seen. But once the commercial real estate losses, and credit card defaults are spiking on cards that are issued by the smaller banks below the top 100. So that's another source of scary quarterly reports coming. I kind of think banks will respond to this by laying people off, as you said, and by dramatically tightening their lending standards, which has already happened. So that slows the economy. That means less money for the banks because they're not making profitable loans. And that means falling stock prices, falling valuations, layoffs, and then an eventual government bailout. So the layoffs are part of this process of the banking sector getting into trouble and the government having to bail them out.
Will the laid off banking workers be replaced by AI and those jobs never come back?
Some will. There's some personal touch banking that can't be replaced yet by AIs, but there's a lot of, the space in between a human teller inside the bank and the ATM machine outside the bank, There are a lot of transactions in between those two things that could be done by AI. So we'll see that on an ongoing basis. That won't necessarily be a 2024 catalyst for any kind of a crisis, but I think it's going to be an ongoing thing that that puts people out of work and puts more pressure on governments to do something about unemployment.
Can the housing market weather the interest rate storm of the last couple of years?
Yeah, housing is a mess in the U.S. It's really, a lot of people are calling it frozen. And that's, it's a legit descriptive for what's happening because interest rates went up and that basically locked all the people who have 2.5% or 3% mortgages into their existing houses, because if they were to leave, they'd have to go and buy another house with an 8% mortgage, which makes it financially unfeasible. So home sales have just contracted to like 1995 levels, even though our population is 50% higher, and nobody is really making much money in the housing sector now. So I don't see that changing anytime soon, because home prices during the low interest rate period were bid up to totally unrealistic levels. So until those prices come back down to the point where they're affordable for, where the median American's income affords the medium home, which is a long way down, I don't think housing can be fixed. So I think what we have to see first is a 40% drop in home prices. Then we can talk about where the housing industry goes. But until that time, it's just frozen with a downward bias in prices.
Uranium's price keeps rising. Would a recession derail that bull market?
A little bit. But uranium is one of the only commodities that's almost impervious to the business cycle, because the world moved away from uranium and then, or from nuclear power, and then concluded that that was a mistake. And now a lot of countries are going back to nuclear, in other words, building new nuclear plants, bringing mothball plants back online. And those plants can't operate unless they have uranium. So they'll be built regardless, because once the plant is in place, you don't stop halfway through building a nuke plant. There isn't enough uranium from today's mines to satisfy all the demand that's projected a few years hence. So the price has to go up enough to incent miners to go out there and find more uranium deposits and bring them to market. And so we'll see higher uranium prices for the next few years. The question is, how high? They've already more or less doubled in the past year. And as Rick Rule says, the easy money has been made, but the upward pressure on demand and therefore prices is still there. So I think it's a good market going forward regardless. And I think the best quality uranium miners are still a buy at this level.
Gold's holding above $2,000 an ounce. Is this level now support instead of resistance?
Ooh, that would be nice, wouldn't it? It remains to be seen, because a couple of bad days and gold can be back below 2,000, and then it's resistance again. But the longer it stays above 2,000, the more the idea will take hold that 2,000 is support, and that resistance is probably several hundred dollars an ounce up above. A lot of people might start thinking in terms of $2,500 an ounce U.S. When that happens, that's great news for the miners, because everybody will recalculate what kind of cash flow a given miner can produce when they're thinking in terms of gold at $2,500 an ounce. Because right now, a lot of mines were brought online with the assumption of $1,800 gold, let's say. And those mines were, theoretically profitable at $1,800. So let gold go up several hundred dollars from there, and that really widens out the operating margins of these miners. So once people come to the conclusion that gold is actually going to stay up in this territory, then they can feel free to reevaluate the miners in terms of the cash flow they're going to generate, and suddenly they're going to look really cheap. So I think the longer gold stays at or above 2,000, the better the chance of a bull market in the mining stocks going forward.
Yeah, so is this good news finally starting to help mining company shares?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. Some of them are up somewhat from where they were, but and occasionally some good news comes out that the market treats as good news, which is unusual. It used to be that for the past few years, an explorer, an exploration company, for instance, would report excellent drill results, and it would be greeted with silence. The stock wouldn't move at all, or maybe the stock would even go down. Lately, good drill results have produced a nice pop in stock prices. So it's possible that psychology is already changing a little bit. And some of the big miners are doing okay. You know, they're up from where they were, although they're still way down from their, multi-year highs. So I think there's a long, long way to run before we can say we're in a rip-roaring gold miners bull market. But lately, we've been heading in the right direction.
How's silver doing compared to gold?
It's doing okay. The gold to silver ratio hasn't changed a lot. It's ticked down a little bit, and gold or silver is, it's flirting with $25 an ounce. That's silver's resistance, and it hasn't broken through it the way gold broke through 2000. So I think what will happen in the future is let's take the positive scenario here that gold stays above 2000 and starts threatening the higher big numbers. You know, it gets up above 2100 or 2200. Well, people are going to start thinking that silver is wildly undervalued, and especially individual demand. You know, consumers will start buying silver coins rather than gold coins because you can get 60 silver ounces for one gold ounce even after the premiums and everything. So I think silver will take off at that point, and then we'll outperform gold until the gold-silver ratio gets down into the 30s, let's say. So that means silver will go up twice as much as gold in this bull market. And I think we'll breach $50 an ounce, which is really resistance for silver. And after that, there might not be any serious resistance until 75. So that could be the way the precious metals bull market goes this time around.
Crude, what's your outlook for that?
I think oil's not going away, contrary to what a lot of governments were saying 2 years ago. We were going to totally replace internal combustion engine cars with electric cars and, just generally ban fossil fuels, and we were going to do it quickly. Well, that's not happening. It turns out that the renewable replacements are not quite ready for prime time, and it's going to be longer, if ever, before we do away with internal combustion engines. So I think oil is in better shape than people thought it was a while back. And on the supply side, a lot of the big oil companies didn't invest as aggressively as they should have because the governments were telling them they were going to go out of business. So there may be supply issues with oil going forward that will keep the price elevated. We'll see. But I think the companies with available reserves in good jurisdictions ought to benefit from that kind of an environment. So some of the better oil companies will do really well going forward, even if oil just stays where it is right now without taking off.
The great taking is getting a lot of press. What is it, and is it for real?
The Great Taking is a book written by a former finance guy who claims that he has discovered that the financial rules in the U.S. have been changed such that our stocks and bonds in our brokerage accounts are not really ours, and they can be taken away in the next crisis. So we'll basically just lose everything in our brokerage accounts. And I haven't read the book or seen the related documentary, but some people I trust have checked it out, and they've come back with a conclusion that this is legit, that the rules really might have changed in this way. And if so, that's about the strongest statement in favor of physical assets that you can imagine, right? Because if you you've got something in your hand. It doesn't matter what the financial rules are. The government can't take it away from you. But your stocks and bonds may not be quite that secure now. So, if the great taking is a real thing, first of all, it's going to invite armed revolution. And second of all, it's yet another reason for gold and silver prices to be a lot higher than they are.
Do you have any New Year's resolutions?
Yeah, I actually kind of do. I mean, one is just a work resolution, which is to finally learn how to use Twitter in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. The other is I just posted a Substack article on something called skill stacking, which in the jobs market, it means, if you add skills that you're reasonably good at, not an expert, just pretty good, you add those, you become much more marketable, and you're in much better shape in terms of your career. In other words, for instance, if you're doing a thing reasonably well, but you add public speaking ability to your skill list, suddenly you become a lot more attractive in a lot of ways for your employer, and you do better in life. Now, you can port that idea over to prepping and say that, all right, if you've got some gold and silver coins and you know how to fix a car, you're in pretty good shape, but you'd be a lot more likely to survive and thrive if you know how to grow 20% of your family's food and you know how to use a firearm reasonably well. You don't have to be an expert, but you shouldn't be a menace to everybody around you, and you can more or less defend yourself. And on, the more survival skills that you accumulate, the better your odds are of coming through what might be a really tempestuous decade in good shape. So I did the first post on that, and I'll make that a series where I look at other skills that we should be accumulating and not mastering, but at least becoming competent in, and where you get the classwork for them and how much it costs and what you can do with it once, blah, 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 that kind of thing. So it's going to be a series which I'm going to participate in. So my New Year's resolution is to get good at some of the many things I'm not good at, but that I should be good at.
John, thank you so much for being on the show. And where can people follow you?
Thanks, Jim. I'm at rubino.substack.com. And the newsletter that I publish there is free to an extent. A lot of what I publish is free to everybody. So you can come sign up for free, check it out. And then there's some actionable stuff behind the paywall that you can check out to see if it's worth it.
John, the best of the new year.
Thanks, Jim. Same to you. Talk to you next year.
My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. Find him on Substack at rubino.substack.com. And that wraps up our show for this week and for this year. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Danielle Park, and John Rubino. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week and next year with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.